This episode of The Sweaty Penguin is brought to you by Microsoft Word. Are you looking to downgrade from Google Docs? Try Microsoft Word today.
Colonial greed is burning down our home. That was what Kaniela Ng, a native Hawaiian and former state representative in Maui, tweeted in the wake of the fires that began 2 weeks ago and have become the deadliest in modern U.S. history. I'm not one to start episodes with such a provocative statement, and especially one from someone in politics. I much prefer to start with a knock-knock joke to break the ice. But I hope you'll bear with me, because regardless of how that statement hits you, there is a clear link between climate change, colonization, and these fires in Maui, clearer than when Taylor walked out on stage in her blue dress and you just knew she was going to announce Taylor's version of 1989. Good Wednesday morning, I'm Ethan Brown, and this is Tip of the Iceberg, where I will break down some environmental news and then answer a question from our listeners on the air. Submit questions via Patreon, email, or social media. Patron questions go to the front of the line, so sign up at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. The Sweaty Penguin is presented by Pearland Promise, a public media initiative from the WNET Group in New York, reporting on the issues and solutions around climate change. You can learn more at pbs.org/pearlandpromise. On August 8th, intense winds from nearby Hurricane Dora led to around 30 downed utility poles, causing outages for over 12,400 customers. These winds and downed power lines contributed to fires in various parts of Maui. In Kula, a fire scorched about 1,000 acres, threatening 554 structures and burning 16, with evidence suggesting a fallen power line as the ignition source. Meanwhile, Lahaina experienced its most devastating fire on August 8th due to a downed power line. This fire led to widespread evacuations, gridlock, and desperate escape attempts, including people diving into the ocean. And no, not the way Californians are currently diving into the ocean with surfboards because, quote, the waves are really good right now. The civil defense sirens remained silent despite the chaos, prompting concerns when the sirens' therapist said it's not good with confrontation. As of August 15th, 106 deaths were confirmed in Lahaina, with search operations still underway. This fire consumed 2,170 acres and destroyed over 2,200 buildings, resulting in damages estimated near $6 billion. The Lahaina fire's death toll became the highest for a U.S. wildfire since 1918. While we're still determining the full picture of what caused the Maui fires, in large part because Owen was not in Hawaii that week, sorry Owen, this joke just can't seem to end. You might even say it's spreading like wildfire. Sorry, that was uncalled for. What we do know, though, are some of the factors that worsened these fires and transformed them into the historic catastrophe they've become. And let's start with drought. Yes, when in doubt, it's probably drought. As of May 23rd, none of Maui was unusually dry. By the following week, it was more than half abnormally dry. And by June 13th, it was two-thirds either abnormally dry or in moderate drought. It's basically the environmental equivalent of complaining about the Fed hiking interest rates on a first date. And 2 weeks ago, about 83% of the island was either abnormally dry or in moderate or severe drought, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. This rapid intensification of dry conditions is called a flash drought. Sort of like a flash mob, both instant, both annoying, and both make your ride to work on the subway extremely sweaty and unpleasant. The flash drought, coupled with extreme heat that has hit almost the entire world this summer, has dried up all the plant life on the island in really quick order. Exactly like my house plants. I am their god and I provided them with drought. I am not proud. And when these plants dry up, they essentially become a tinderbox, ready to light on fire the second there's a lightning strike, unattended campfire, or your gender reveal party gets a little too rowdy. Speaking of plant life, the plants themselves also play a role. Invasive species like bufflegrass, guinea grass, and molasses grass now occupy nearly a quarter of Hawaii's landmass, and these grasses are really flammable. It's like when TikTok chefs put dry spaghetti into a glass baking dish, pour on some marinara sauce, and think they can just bake it. Like, what are you doing? Boil some water and cook your pasta like a sane person! Bufflegrass burns nearly twice as hot as other grasses, guinea grass is extremely drought resistant, which allows it to grow in thicker stands, creating more tinder for a fire, and molasses grass is actually coated with a residue that enables it to catch fire even while green. Maui also has a lot of non-native conifers on the island, and in the past, wildfires have caused the cones of these conifers to explode, which both worsened the fires and spread seeds to new parts of the island, which then led to more of these non-native trees growing, and yes, kids, that's how fire babies are made. And then, there's Hurricane Dora.
Hola, soy Dora. Do you know what caused the wildfire?
No! I said it was too soon for Dora jokes. Hawaii sits in a bit of a strange weather spot in the Pacific Ocean. North of Hawaii is a high-pressure system known as the North Pacific High. North Pacific High is also my favorite fish school. That joke had multiple layers, I just want to be sure you had time to appreciate them all. South of Hawaii, by the equator, is a low-pressure system, and no, not LA dating low-pressure, where it's actually high-pressure because people are incapable of basic communication. The equator is, of course, where the hottest air is, and as you know, if you've ever lived in an apartment with no air conditioning, hot air rises. And because of the high pressure to the north of Hawaii and low pressure to the south, we have regularly occurring trade winds blowing from north to south right through Hawaii. Now, if you remember back to any of our past hurricane episodes, hurricanes form around unusually low-pressure systems. They love to keep it casual. So Hurricane Dora was a Category 4 hurricane that was traveling about 500 miles south of Hawaii at the time of the fires. Dora did not hit Hawaii, she apparently lost her backpack that had the map in it. But because there was such low pressure south of the islands, there were unusually strong trade winds at the time, blowing from north to south, with gusts reaching up to 60 miles per hour. Even though I could totally beat that in my car, those winds were not great for Maui. These winds can increase oxygen supply, carry heat and burning embers, and bend flames closer to unburned areas, all of which would have worsened the fires in Maui. That's right, Dora is a firebender now. Who would have seen that coming? Also, for the record, I'm pretty confident that Swiper caused the fires.
Swiper, no swiping!
Thank you, Dora. Yes, she is on payroll, obviously, and definitely not problematic in any way. Now, we don't know the precise degree to which climate change influenced all these various factors. We do know from Climate Central's Climate Shift Index that on August 7th and August 8th, the west coast of Maui, including Lahaina, had heat days made at least 5 times likelier due to climate change and Jason Bateman being on the beach, but wildfires are a lot more complicated than a couple hot days leading up to them. Aside from that, I couldn't find any direct analyses of how climate change drove these specific fires just yet, That's a bit harder to calculate because there's a lot of different factors, but I'm sure scientists will research that. In the meantime, we can make some more overarching observations. A study in Science from April of this year found that flash droughts are becoming increasingly more common due to human-caused climate change. This makes sense, since bigger precipitation swings and hotter temperatures are going to lead drought conditions to onset faster than they used to. The invasive grass species I mentioned earlier are all quite drought-resistant, making them more likely to outcompete native grasses in a changed climate. I mean, you know I'm taking Buffelgrass first overall in my fantasy grass league. Also, Kentucky bluegrass is my late-round sleeper pick, if anyone was wondering. And hurricanes are becoming more severe due to climate change. As I've said in past episodes, heat is energy. It's like Dwayne Johnson and The Rock, or Subway tuna and blended sardines with mayonnaise. But because heat is energy, warmer temperatures allow hurricane winds to pick up speed more quickly and result in more intense hurricanes. Hurricane Dora, in particular, actually made history, setting a record for longevity in the Pacific Ocean and becoming the second tropical system ever to remain at hurricane strength across the eastern, central, and western Pacific basins. Since western Pacific hurricanes are called typhoons, Hurricane Dora actually became Typhoon Dora later that week, and I must say, after all the bad press, it was really smart of Dora to rebrand. So that's the climate connection as we know it to this point. What about the colonization connection? To explain that, let's do a very quick overview of the history of Hawaii. In the 1870s, Hawaii was still an independent kingdom, ruled by King Kalakaua. Their economy was substantially transformed by the Reciprocity Treaty of 1875, which allowed specific Hawaiian exports like sugar to enter the US duty-free. And thank goodness, because Harry Houdini loved Sour Patch Kids. This led to significant profits for American planters and expanded US influence on the islands. As the influence of these American settlers grew, they began to shape the Hawaiian economy in ways that primarily benefited them. Large-scale agriculture, especially sugar plantations, became the economic backbone. Over time, this transition to plantation agriculture often displaced native Hawaiians from their ancestral lands. By 1893, tensions culminated in the overthrow of Queen Liliuokalani, the last reigning monarch of Hawaii, by a group of US-backed businessmen and planters. Sanford B. Dole, an American lawyer and jurist in the Hawaiian Islands, led the coup and was later appointed as the first governor of Hawaii when it was annexed to the United States in 1898. His cousin once removed, James Dole, started the Hawaiian Pineapple Company, which is now Dole Food Company. That's right, the namesake of your Dole Whip did that. Guess that's reason number 15 to opt for the turkey leg instead. It's a wild story, though. Pineapples are not even native to Hawaii. They came from Bikini Bottom. Just kidding, they came from South America and were brought to the island around this time. In other words, we should probably stop calling it Hawaiian pizza and start calling it colonizer pizza. But anyway, enough about pineapples. Back to the other depressing stuff. That annexation, largely driven by geopolitical and economic interests, especially amidst the backdrop of the Spanish-American War, was extremely controversial to say the least, and led to the suppression of native Hawaiian culture, traditions, and rights. Despite the egregious fact that thought, through, though, and tough are all basically the same spelling, they managed to make English the dominant language and even ban the Hawaiian language from schools. Traditional customs and practices were often marginalized, while American customs, holidays, and traditions took prominence. Native Hawaiians were systemically marginalized in their own homeland, facing land disposition, diseases brought by foreigners, and reduced economic opportunities. And then in 1959, Hawaii was named the 50th state in the Union. And besides fixing the fact that 49 was just a really awkward number, this too was extremely controversial. While it promised enhanced representation and federal support, it also further institutionalized U.S. control over Hawaiian affairs. The Hawaiian economy continued to transition away from its roots toward American interests such as tourism, which brought some economic opportunities, but also some challenges, pricing Native Hawaiians out of their homes, sometimes neglecting to provide living wages, and leaving a legacy where last December, Aloha United Way found in their ALICE report that 27% of Native Hawaiians are living in poverty, which is nearly double the statewide average. Furthermore, tourism has led to the misrepresentation and commodification of Native Hawaiian culture, an issue which has sparked discussion and debate to this day. If you were wondering, no, locals don't actually wear coconut bras and grass skirts. Trust me, I got a lot of really dirty looks when I stepped off the plane in that outfit. To this day, Native Hawaiians do not receive the same federal recognition that Indian tribes and Native Alaskans do, even though they are also an indigenous group that faced American colonization. So what does this have to do with the Maui fires? For one, I would be remiss not to mention the historical sites that were damaged in the fire, and no, that does not include the places where Lilo and Stitch was filmed. Lahaina was the capital of the Kingdom of Hawaii from 1820 to 1845, and the center of the global whaling industry in the 1800s, and now Lahaina is barely recognizable, and not in a OMG girl you glowed up type of way. Actually, I guess she did technically glow up, but we're not going to debate this right now. Among other sites, the Old Lahaina Courthouse, which houses the Lahaina Heritage Museum, showcasing artifacts from the monarchy and other periods throughout the island's history, has burned down. The Baldwin Home, Lahaina's oldest building, originally occupied by a 19th century physician and missionary who helped vaccinate much of Maui against smallpox, has burned down. And the largest banyan tree in the United States, which was planted in 1873, a full 100 years before Neil Patrick Harris was born, has been a longtime symbol of Lahaina, and just celebrated its 150th anniversary in April, was engulfed in flames. And while the tree appears to still be standing, experts are evaluating the scope of the damage. Here's to hoping it continues to outlive Neil Patrick Harris. Or better yet, they both live forever. That barely scratches the surface of the damage to historically and culturally significant artifacts on the island. But here's the other piece, which ties back to what we discussed earlier. Remember how I talked about those non-native grasses and conifer trees making the fires worse? How did they get there? Bufflegrass, for example, was first brought to Hawaii in 1935 by researchers and was seen as a useful grass for livestock grazing. Its drought resistance, shade tolerance, high palatability, and nutritional value made it a preferred alternative to native grasses for the agriculture industry. And unsurprisingly, the stronger bufflegrass spread fast, beating out other native species like sourgrass, which does not taste like sourdough. Ironically, I learned that from a piece I found written in 1957, talking about how great and awesome bufflegrass is for Hawaii. Like, bruh, undo it. You're playing with fire. But as tourism has replaced agriculture as Hawaii's primary industry, there haven't been as many animals to graze on bufflegrass or any of the other aforementioned invasive grasses, leading their populations to explode. They really be multiplying like rabbits. But grass rabbits. That's why today, these extremely flammable grasses occupy a quarter of Hawaii's landmass. With conifer trees, it's a similar story. I read a U.S. Forest Service paper from 1963 that started with the following. Each year, Hawaii imports 70 to 100 million board feet of lumber. Of this amount, about 92% is softwood. Obviously, locally produced softwood construction lumber would find a ready market if it could compete with imports in quality and price. Yeah, obviously. If I grow an apple tree in my studio apartment, it will save me tons of money buying apples at Vons, and I don't see any possible downside to doing that. Yes, I would probably get lots of bees, but they would split the rent with me 20,000 ways, so don't tell my landlord. But that paper I quoted was real. And with that logic, colonizers introduced a variety of conifers to Hawaii to provide their preferred lumber, leading to the non-native conifer forests exacerbating wildfire damage today. For both of these reasons, colonization quite literally directly made the Maui fires worse. I mean, that's as clear as it gets. Even clearer than the fact that Taylor's When Emma Falls in Love is about Kieran Culkin, not Andrew Garfield. Apparently this joke is going in every episode now. And if we want to take this one step further, outside the confines of Hawaii, colonization has also played a major role in climate change. I'm not going to take this argument further than I should, but let's look at the facts. In 1840, European colonizers started confiscating land from the Maori tribes in New Zealand to chop down their forests for timber, creating a situation where present-day New Zealand has at least 60% fewer forests than before European colonization. How they ended up with the cheeriest accents in the world after that is beyond me. In the late 1800s, French colonizers in North and West Africa banned locals from practicing subsistence farming, requiring them to chop down their forests to make ways for cotton plantations and other crops. At the same time, British colonizers cut down most wildfire-resistant oak and deodar forests in India and replaced them with large-scale pine plantations for producing resin, and now dry pine needles are responsible for wildfires in India every summer. And that list goes on, and if you need to take a nap or a few deep breaths or an all-in-one spa and massage treatment after hearing that, I'll let you take a second. We good to continue? Good. We can even go back further to the 1600s, when colonizers cleared and burned almost all the forests of New England to such an extreme that in 1809, Samuel Williams, a math and philosophy professor at Harvard, who was actually one of John Quincy Adams' favorite teachers, wrote that, quote, "The earth is no sooner laid open to the influence of the sun and winds than the effects of cultivation begin to appear. The surface of the earth becomes more warm and dry." Or as we say in 2023 English, we goofed that one. But he was right. The soil was literally warmer, drier, and more flood-prone in New England after colonizers cleared the land. Try fitting all of that on a needlepoint pillow. And beyond that, every single one of these deforestation stories isn't just stealing and altering land, but when we put them all together, they actually impact climate change. Remember, forests are made up of trees, which suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and store it away. Better yet, they don't need a plastic straw to do it. How sustainable of them, right? I would never. Cutting or burning forests down can have the opposite effect. It can release carbon. According to a 2018 study in Nature, the world has lost 35% of its forests in the last 300 years, and of those that have survived, 82% have been compromised by human activity. And land use change, principally deforestation, but also forest degradation, contributes 12 to 20% of global greenhouse gas emissions, according to a 2020 report from the Heinrich Böll Foundation. In fact, some degraded forests that once stored carbon are now releasing carbon, including even parts of the Amazon. At this rate, Amazon's going to be releasing more carbon than Amazon. That's this week's Have a Think for ya. All of this is to say, colonization led to these extreme land use changes that have played a role in climate change today. How about fossil fuels? If you go back through our carbon bomb episodes, most of them involve indigenous land and indigenous opposition. In the Bakken Formation episode, we talked about Native Americans opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline. In the Montney Formation episode, we talked about First Nation communities in Canada whose Treaty 8 land was stolen for natural gas production. In the Rovuma Basin episode, we talked about Global North companies exploiting a war zone in Mozambique for LNG production, and the fuel won't even get to be used by locals. How we turned that one into comedy, I'll never know. We can even look to our recent episode on the Bovenyenkovo gas field, where profits from Russia's largest natural gas field are bankrolling the war in Ukraine, which many have deemed a colonial war. How we turned that into comedy? I guess the humor was mostly me failing to pronounce Russian city names. Even in cases where indigenous communities support oil and gas drilling, such as the Willow Project, I have to wonder if they would be in a position to need that economic or energy development if it weren't for past colonization. These are just a few examples out of many, but again, you can see how these colonial activities, which have continued to present day, are driving fossil fuel production and consequently climate change. For all of these reasons and more, in 2022, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change wrote in their sixth assessment report, quote, "Present development challenges causing high vulnerability are influenced by historical and ongoing patterns of inequity, such as colonialism, especially for many indigenous peoples and local communities. Officials and scientists from around the globe now recognize the significant role colonialism has played in heating our planet and destroying its many gifts." And you thought it was Santa crashing his sleigh into a manatee destroying the gifts, silly. Remember, this report is a summary of scientific research done over the last several years. This isn't some political statement. This is as academically backed and vetted as it can be. Although my high school English teacher would still find some reason to give it a B+. Understanding all of that, when I hear a native Hawaiian say colonial greed is burning down our home, it's actually not that provocative a statement. Honestly, saying grape jelly is better than strawberry jelly causes more of a disputable reaction. I know it's not fun to think about, but it's backed by history and science. And if I can give one note of hope on this very, very sad story, if we can understand that colonization created conditions that exacerbated the Maui fires, then we can maybe appreciate why indigenous perspectives are essential in the pursuit of solutions. Maui is not new to fires, but Native Hawaiians know how to manage the land. They've been there for thousands of years, way longer than the pineapples. They had a system called ahupua'a, which organized self-sufficient communities based on the flow of water, and many present-day Hawaiians advocate using principles from the ahupua'a system to restore land today. Sadly, colonization led to the suppression of lots of traditional knowledge and practices, but it is still there. That knowledge and that insight is one thing these fires did not burn down. We did an episode a couple months ago on a variety of wildfire solutions, so I encourage you to check that out. But today, in this instance, I want to put at the top of that list, listening to Native Hawaiians. That's not that hot a take, I know. But after the recovery from these fires, there needs to be planning for how to avoid a catastrophe like this in the future. It absolutely can be avoided. Yes, there will be more fires, but there are plenty of steps that can be taken to prevent them from being as deadly and catastrophic as this one. And even during the recovery, we need to understand this stuff. There have been stories all over social media of locals in Maui sharing that investors and realtors are aggressively calling them to try to get the people who lost their homes to sell their land. At this rate, they're gonna make $1 million listing Maui edition. Imagine the confessionals mid-colonization. I mean, even Andy Cohen can't moderate that conversation. But seriously, can we read the room? The answer to a fire worsened by colonization is not more colonization. It's like when I try to fix my terrible sleep schedule by taking a nap, except it actually matters. If people want to sell their homes, that's fine, that's great. But if they don't, as seems to be the case, let's not cold call them, but support them and listen to them as we find a path forward. And I promise I won't steal their strategy for my fantasy grass league. And now, here's Valina with the news.
Hi there, I'm Valina, and this is your weekly environmental news update. A new Nature Communication study indicates that the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, a crucial system of ocean currents, could collapse as early as 2025 due to global heating. Which is crazy, because people collapse due to global heating all the time and you don't hear them whining about it. But in all seriousness, the collapse would lead to catastrophic climate impacts worldwide. And you thought a 10th Fast and Furious movie was the problem. Its collapse would disrupt rain patterns critical for food production in regions like India, South America, and West Africa, increase storms and lower temperatures in Europe, raise sea levels on the eastern coast of North America, and endanger the Amazon rainforest and Antarctic ice sheets. So it's kind of pretty bad. In fact, the only thing it won't change is mommy vloggers and their endless mission to make content out of their children. On July 26th, the White House initiated a new cabinet-level task force. Their headquarters are right above the kitchen counter. The task force is aimed at utilizing technology to detect and mitigate methane leaks, which, coincidentally, is also the newest TikTok feature. This move coincided with the White House's first methane summit, gathering leaders and companies involved in methane reduction efforts. Several others tried to join due to a miscommunication when they thought this was for fans of Breaking Bad. The task force will focus on policy enforcement and technology development to tackle methane emissions, particularly those from the oil and gas industry, as well as me and my colleagues after a long night at the local Taco Bell cantina. A four-day summit held in India last month by some of the world's wealthiest nations, the G20, concluded without any commitments to reduce fossil fuel use or increase the development of renewable energy. I mean, come on, guys. What were you doing there? Playing G20, the newest handheld 20 questions game? Opposition from Saudi Arabia, China, and Russia was primarily responsible for this deadlock. Apparently, China was furious at the lack of effort from other nations to, quote, get those kids off their damn phones. On the bright side, it could prove helpful for the U.S. to point to efforts like that new methane task force at home to encourage some of these more hesitant countries to accelerate their efforts as well. Or as the kids like to say, get in, loser, we're tackling methane emissions. Amazon has announced plans to construct Mississippi's first utility-scale wind farm, named the Delta Wind Farm, which I guess is better than my idea. Fart farm. The Delta Wind Farm will include 41 wind turbines and produce enough clean energy to power about 80,000 homes annually. Spirit Airlines was in talks to be the namesake of the farm, but the Mississippi government wanted to go in a direction that didn't strike fear into the hearts of its users, and didn't involve a civilian cranking a big lever to operate the turbines. Once operations begin sometime in 2024, Amazon will have 6 renewable energy facilities in Mississippi, contributing to over 400 worldwide, which is awesome, and also aids in the answer to the question, people live in Mississippi? Wind energy now powers over 10% of the U.S. electric grid, which was the airbender's plan all along. And this added capacity marks yet another step in the direction of clean energy. Alexa, play Wind of Change by Scorpions, while I play G20, the newest handheld 20 questions game, brought to you by the G20 Summit. That's all for today's update. See you next week. Do you wish that you could type your manifestos on a program that prompts you to update every single time you open your computer? Then Microsoft Word is for you. With Microsoft Word, you can type up anything in the world, as long as it's not a proper noun or a unique name. Best of all, you'll get some alone time with one of the most iconic tech mascots of all time, Clippy. If he likes you, he'll ramble about the good old days before ashing his cigarette on your document. Lucky you. Microsoft Word. Don't you dare move that goddamn image.
The Sweaty Penguin is presented by Peril and Promise, a public media initiative from the WNET Group in New York, reporting on the issues and solutions around climate change. You can learn more at pbs.org/perilandpromise. Welcome back to Tip of the Iceberg. It's time for Ask Me Anything, where our listeners get a chance to ask me any environmental questions they may have. Submit questions via Patreon, email, or social media. Patron questions go to the front of the line, so be sure to sign up at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. We have a caller on the line today. We have Lital here. Lital, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. Thanks for taking my call.
So you have a question for us?
Yeah. So, you know, this everything, I know you've been talking about what's going on in Montana and the ruling that happened there. And I've been thinking a lot about wildfires and things that go on in multiple states. And I know Montana is a state that has many wildfires where, you know, anti-climate legislation, what's happening is only making these wildfires worse. And in other states like California, there's things going on where, you know, the government is banning certain things in hopes of protecting the trees, let's say, or protecting our nature. But what that's doing in return is causing more wildfires, right? Which is, it's like a double-edged sword because now all the trees have burned anyway, right? So they're banning, you know, some of these places I've heard, they're banning, you know, planned fires that are supposed to help stop the spread of wildfires and fires in general. But yet, so they've banned those to try to protect the trees, yet it's not, clearly not working. And so in situations like what the ruling was in Montana, you know, where is this line? Where do we cross the line? How does our government, what's right and what's wrong? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So first off, for anyone who didn't see the case of Held v. Montana, which we discussed, I think, a couple months ago, as you mentioned, the case was decided last week, and the ruling was in favor of the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs were 16 people aged 5 to 22 who were arguing that a provision in Montana's permitting law that said that the state could not evaluate greenhouse gas emissions in their permitting decisions, that was unconstitutional. Montana's state constitution has a stated right to a clean and healthful environment. And so basically to argue that law violated that right, they had to prove climate science in court, which was a very interesting thing to see. But they succeeded at that. They won the case, and it could have ramifications for other cases like it around the country. There's a national one, Juliana v. USA, I believe, that's coming up, as well as some other state-level ones. To the point about wildfires, obviously, very important issue right now. I think that there could be a connection because, first off, on the national level, and I'm not quite as familiar on the state level, but I know on the national level, to get started on a forest management project, you need to get environmental permits, and that can take years to happen. and we don't have years because the next fire could have happened at any time. So it's important to obviously make sure that a project we're doing won't harm the environment, but we also don't want to harm the environment by taking too long to permit wildfire management projects. Like you said, there's a lot that we can do to try to prevent wildfires, from removing brush to doing logging to doing controlled burns, all these different things that are really important, just land management. And some of these permitting things are getting in the way, just general, I think, fear of what controlled burns means for people who have not been land managers or grown up with this type of land. I understand why that can be a little scary, but it's very important and very doable. And then beyond that, I think I've mentioned before, 85% of wildland fires in the U.S. are caused by human negligence. So be it unattended campfires or cigarette butts or fireworks or out of control gender reveal parties, or that's a lot of what actually gets these fires started. So just educating people and understanding what impact we have on this is important too. I hope that in light of what is a very sad story coming out of Maui and others like it coming out of the Western U.S. and Canada and around the world, that we can understand that there are solutions to these things. We can make a positive step forward. And I don't know to what degree the Montana case is going to affect wildfire management in the state. Certainly it will affect energy permitting, but certainly it's good to see a piece of news like that in a challenging time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for the help. That is a very interesting perspective. And also, yeah, we are responsible too. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the question. I appreciate it. That does it for this week's episode of Tip of the Iceberg. Take 2 minutes, help out the show, and get a shout-out at the end of the show by leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple or Podcast Addict, or join our Patreon at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. There you get merch, bonus content, and your questions move to the front of the line for Tip of the Iceberg. And by the way, if you ever want to do a call-in, feel free to drop me a line, shoot me an email, let me know on social media, whatever works best for you, and we can make that happen. The Sweaty Penguin is presented by Peril and Promise, a public media initiative from the WNET Group in New York, reporting on the issues and solutions around climate change. You can learn more at pbs.org/perilandpromise. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and guests. They do not necessarily reflect the opinions or views of Peril and Promise or the WNET Group. Thank you all for listening, and I'll see you on Friday for a deep dive on vinyl chloride. This was the chemical that was leaked in the East Palestine train derailment in Ohio earlier this year. We did a Tip of the Iceberg on the derailment itself, but we've got a whole episode coming on this specific chemical, so very interesting stuff. Be sure to check that out. I will see you then.